This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor. From fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB public media app.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Creature Comforts, the show all about your animals and the animals around you. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and Libby Hartfield, retired director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. Previously on Creature Comforts, we had Christian Wagley from Healthy Gulf on to discuss the then newly discovered species of Rice's whale. As the coastal organizer for Florida and Alabama, Christian returns today to update us on these whales and shed light on what we've learned about them. Also, Dr. Major is ready for some pet questions, and Libby always likes to hear about your recent brushes with nature. So join our conversation this morning. You can email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. And we always like to remind you that if you miss Creature Comforts on Thursday, it repeats Saturday mornings at 6. So good morning to everyone. Libby, what interesting things have you been seeing outside your window these past couple of days?
Hi, Kevin. I'm out here right now in the woods on Dolphin Island.
Okay.
We've been down here for the last 3 days. We come every year to see the migrating birds, try to welcome home the migrating songbirds that come across the Gulf, and many of them come across this little island. And it's a beautiful place and a beautiful habitat for their stopover. Maybe not as many species. Last year we really had a whole, caught a whole lot of diversity in the migrants that were coming through. This year we've seen about 50 species, a little over 50, which is good, really very good. And when you think about the incredible feat, we feel like the least we can do is kind of come and honor the birds as they come across. It's a tremendous feat for some of them. We saw a whole lot of black pole warblers over the course of the last 3 days, and I guess, gosh, I would say maybe 24 at least we saw. So if we saw that many, there were a lot of them. And they nest almost entirely in Canada. There'll be some up in Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, but they're pretty much a very northern nesting bird, but they winter in South and Central America. So it's a long flight. They had a very long flight. And some of them will go as far as Alaska. Like there was a documented bird that was tagged and went from Denali to South America and back each year. So it's quite a feat for a tiny little black and white bird that makes his way through, and he spends just a very little time in the southern United States. We saw a whole bunch of grosbeaks, which we do have around us, and they nest in Mississippi. They nest all in the southeastern states. So they had a relatively short flight up from South and Central America. A lot of them winter in Mexico. So, it sounds like a long flight. They can fly nonstop for 20 hours across the Gulf.
Wow.
But part of the reason for coming here to Dolphin Island, Kevin, is that when they come in here, they're tired and hungry, thirsty, so people have out food, and there's a lot of natural vegetation, which is the very best way to take care of our birds, we know. They have native plants that they need. There are mulberry trees here, and the mulberry trees are loaded right now with fruit, and so the birds, literally, after flying all the way across the Gulf, they step right down in these mulberry trees, and they obviously don't care who's watching. They're hungry and tired, and so it's a good place to be respectful and sit down quietly and watch them come and go. And sometimes they stay for several days. Sometimes they touch down and eat and drink, and it's like a pit stop for them, and then they're back flying north. Depending on, their level of health and how much body fat they've got, what they need to do. But it's been lots and lots of fun.
Yeah, my brother and I think we're at in Dolphin Island. I think it was last year, and a lot of great nature trails there. And also, they have, I think it might be being under construction, but there's a good aquarium down there as well.
Yeah, really good aquarium. And, you know, some of the people, in fact, you know, our guest, Christian Wagley, some of his coworkers are here at the Dolphin Island Marine Lab, I believe.
I think that's where the aquarium is, or it's connected with that, I think, if I'm trying to remember it correctly. Is. But, yeah.
Yeah, and we're camping really right across from them in a little campground that's been here forever. There's the old fort is here, mm-hmm. Fort Gaines, and then the Marines facility. It's pretty big. There's dormitories for students and the public aquarium and classrooms and lots of things. Ruth Carmichael, that has been on our show before to talk about manatees, her offices are here. So it's a great place for all kinds of science. And this month, particularly, April is just the time that we know the migration is going to be going strong. And this is because of the way it's situated in the Gulf and because of the way the predominant winds are, Dolphin Island is almost always a great place to see these migrants. I'm interested in some of the birds that live here year-round that I hardly ever see. I had never gotten to see a clapper rail until this week. I've heard them, and they make a really interesting clacking sound. And so the clapper rail was a neat bird that I could never get a look at one. And I have some birding friends that are from Tennessee that we only see here once a year. And he's a really good birder and told me that he could take me to see one. And I had to work at it a little bit, but we finally saw a clapper rail and got to watch him as he clacked. He kind of looked right at us and sang to us. I could, you know, see his beak open and moving even without my binoculars. So it was pretty cool. Got to spend some time with a bird that I had wanted to see and never gotten to before.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're joined each week, as we always are, by Dr. Troy Major from his clinic in Jackson. So, Dr. Major, our producer, Abram, says that his puppy turned 1 year old yesterday. So that's a kind of a fun landmark. Is it time at the one-year mark for a puppy to get another checkup?
You know, possibly. It depends on, usually we say when he had his last set of shots, which usually is around 4 months of age. So it may be a little early to do that, but certainly nothing wrong with getting him in for a checkup. Sounds like he's doing good. He's a year old, is that correct?
Right, it's at, apparently he turned a year old just yesterday.
Okay. Well, I think he needs to ask his vet, but I would say this, that normally if you finish your shots, puppy shots, at about 4 months of age, that it would follow a year from when you finish those shots for his next checkup.
Okay. And after that initial round of shots and vaccinations at that at the checkup, what sort of things are you looking for, which would be what, about a year and a half old of the puppy?
Right. Normally you'd have a check for heartworms, just a small blood sample will do, and stool exam, and just repeat the annual vaccinations, because with the rabies vaccination, for example, we do use 3-year rabies vaccine, but for the second shot, after the first time, they like to repeat that. And then it can be every year, depending on the susceptibility of the animal. In other words, a dog or a cat, if they're outside all the time, I recommend yearly vaccination with that. So it's a good time for a checkup just to see physical. There may be things that you see as a pet owner that the veterinarian might not pick up in the brief exam type thing. So be sure to tell if there are any issues, whether it has to do with weight loss, weight gain, or any irregular type situations that the puppy may have.
And I think that Abram has a female dog. Is there any difference in terms of how frequently you should take a pet to the vet based on whether it's male or female?
You know, not really. I suspect that he's had this puppy, I call her puppy, but this female, she may have already been spayed, which I would expect has happened. So generally just yearly checkups, or some people would rather have a semi-annual checkup, but definitely a yearly checkup for your dog or cat.
All right. Looks like we got an early caller on the line. So before our first break, let's talk to Elizabeth, who's calling in from Jackson. Good morning, Elizabeth. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know if this is a question for Libby or Dr. Raiders or both, but I live in a busy part of Jackson on Ridgewood Road, and for at least, probably a month and a half now, maybe a little bit longer, there's been a single Canadian goose who has been kind of living, if you will, in the yards of three different houses, very close to the street. He is not approachable. He gets scared by humans. But I'm nervous for him because he's staying in these yards very close to the street, has been in the street and almost gotten hit by cars a couple of times. There's, as far as I know, no kind of natural body of water in our block. And so I just didn't know. His behavior seems a little off. It seems like an odd place for him to have made his home. And I did not know if that was something to be concerned about and if there was an organization that could help.
Anybody have some thoughts on that?
You know, my information is on that one, maybe to call the Department of Wildlife Fisheries and Parks. It's a...
You know, Libby, it sounds like he may have lost his mate. You know, a lot of times a single bird is a little bit rare to see a single Canadian Canada goose, and I would say that may have happened. And you good advice to call Fisheries and Wildlife, I would think.
Yeah, talk to... if you just call the switchboard, Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, and talk to them about it. See if there's an officer that can give you a little help with that.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right, Elizabeth, we appreciate your calling in today. This is Creature Comforts. We'll talk about the relatively new discovered Rice's whale from the organization Healthy Gulf. We'll be talking this hour with Christian Wagley. Also, Dr. Major and Libby are here for creature questions and wildlife observations. So if you'd like to join the conversation this morning, you can always email the show, send it to animals@mpbonline.org. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major and Libby Hartfield. If you want to join our conversation this morning with your question or comment, email animals@mpbonline.org. As I mentioned at the top of the show, our guest today is Christian Wagley from Healthy Gulf. He's the coastal organizer for Florida and Alabama, where he works to protect water quality, create a healthy energy future, and improve coastal resilience in communities along the Florida Panhandle and southeast Alabama. Christian, thanks for joining us on the show this morning.
Yes, good morning. It's so good to be with you all.
So if you would, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to work with Healthy Gulf and interested in protecting the coastal waters.
Sure. I have a master's degree in kind of coastal environmental science and have worked on a variety of environmental issues, mainly in the panhandle of Florida and along the Gulf Coast for the past 25 years or so, and went to work for Healthy Gulf about 6.5 years ago. We're a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to the Gulf of Mexico and the people and communities along its shores. And we're based in New Orleans, but we have staff working in all Gulf states from Florida to Texas on a variety of issues related to water quality, endangered species, climate change, energy exploration, variety, so many things to keep us busy on the Gulf Coast.
So tell us a little bit about your personal interest in whales.
Well, I think most everybody, humans have a natural affinity for nature. You know, the famous entomologist E.O. Wilson called it biophilia. We like nature, we benefit from nature, and we have this affinity for it. And whales are one of those animals that we call charismatic megafauna. These are the big animals that kind of evoke this warm and fuzzy feeling in us that people love. It's the whales, it's the sea turtles, bears, manatees, things like that. And so whales are certainly chief among them. And so like most anybody that's a nature lover, I've always been interested in whales, but until the Rice's whale came along and this really became a big issue in the Gulf of Mexico, I didn't work on them directly until that. And that big announcement came of the Rice's whale as a distinct species about 3 years ago. And in fact, I was on your show then to talk about that.
And do you think part of the attraction is the fact that these are aquatic animals and it's kind of a foreign environment that they live in?
Well, I think it could be. I mean, obviously, those of us on the Gulf Coast, the Gulf of Mexico is a huge part of our identity. Probably a lot of us wouldn't be here without that. And we are fascinated by the creatures that are out there. And even those creatures like the Rice's whales that we're unlikely to see. Rice's whales tend to live farther offshore. They don't come in right along the beaches. And there's only around 50 animals remaining. They're critically endangered. So our likelihood of seeing them is not great, but that's an interesting thing about human beings is that we can care about something even though we're unlikely to see it. I mean, I have grown up loving big cats, lions, and tigers, even though I've never seen one in the wild, right? And probably never will travel to one of those places to see them. But that's a wonderful thing about human beings is we can care about things like that.
So you mentioned the Rice's whales. I think at one point were they believed to be a different kind of whale?
Right. You know, it's important to note that Healthy Gulf and other organizations have worked on these whales and their conservation and protection for many decades. But they were believed to be a subspecies of an animal called the Brutus whale. The Brutus whale is a species of whale that ranges in temperate seas around the world. And then there are subpopulations or subspecies of those in certain water bodies. And for a number of years, this was called basically a Gulf of Mexico population of Brutus whales. Although about 20 years ago, scientists really started to think more and more that this might be a fully distinct species, but they needed to get more evidence, right? Science is based on the data and based on the evidence. And so that opportunity came unfortunately with a dead whale coming ashore in 2019. But scientists took that unique opportunity to study that whale more closely. Now they had an intact skeleton, which they never had before, and they had some material to do some DNA analysis on. And so they compared the skull of this whale that came ashore with other Brutus whales, and that showed that it was a fully distinct species. And then some new genetic work as well showed that it was a fully distinct species separate from the Brutus whale. And that's when the big announcement came in 2021. The paper was published, and it was renamed the Rice's whale after a longtime whale researcher named Dale Rice, who wrote a first paper about the whales here in the Gulf of Mexico, this particular whale, all the way back in 1965.
And I think you mentioned there's only 50 of these whales left. So tell us, if you would, some of the problems that they face.
Well, I mean, whales worldwide face just a host of threats, and that includes the Rice's whales here in the Gulf of Mexico. And for the federal government through NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they're really the ones that are the overseers of the conservation of this whale, which, by the way, is required by law, the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so they've identified a number of main threats to the whales. That's energy exploration, which is mainly oil and gas. It's vessel traffic, it's shipping, both to and from ports, and also the shipping traffic that serves the offshore oil and gas industry. It's noise from ocean noise from both of those, from the oil and gas operations. The drilling is a very noisy thing. There's constant seismic exploration where explosions are generated from ships, and those are directed at the sea bottom to find new deposits of oil and gas. And then vessels themselves are noisy as well. So those are big threats, as I mentioned, the vessel strikes from that shipping traffic. There's also things like that are not there yet that are a potential threat, and that's proposed aquaculture activities. They're looking at creating large offshore fish farms in the Gulf of Mexico, and that can be an entanglement hazard. These floating fish farms where whales can be entangled on those. So those are some of the main threats that are out there.
So how are some of these problems being addressed?
Well, you know, frankly, they're not being fully addressed yet in terms of actual conservation measures that are actually out there at sea. So they've identified what these main threats are. And right now, there's a lot of tension around actually enacting some of these measures that would be needed to protect these whales from harm, which, again, is required by law. The groups, including Healthy Gulf and a number of other national partners, petitioned NOAA for speed restrictions on vessels in a relatively narrow band of offshore where the whales are most common. Petitioned for that a couple of years ago, and NOAA rejected that last year for now. We expect that will come back again, because speed restrictions on vessels is a proven way to to protect whales worldwide. It gives the whales time to get out of the way of a ship. It gives a ship captain time to take evasive action. And it's a fairly common thing more and more now on seaports where ships are having to slow down in some particular area as they approach land in order to protect whales. And this is happening in ports worldwide. But I'll tell you, the biggest thing coming up here soon is this summer. We expect in August, the federal government will designate what's called critical habitat for the whales. And every endangered species gets a map that's published that says, this is where this animal lives, and this is the area that's critical to protect them in. And that map was published in draft form last year. It shows the deeper water areas where the shelf drops off between about 100 and 400 meters from the Florida Keys all the way around the Gulf Coast over to the Texas-Mexico border. So that will come out in August. And that will give some protections to the whales by requiring that any federal actions like permitting and other actions that intersect with that area are going to require additional scrutiny and protections for the whales.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. And today we're talking about the Rice's whale with our guest, Christian Wagley. We'll have more whale talk in just a few minutes, but we do have a couple of phone calls to get to. And so we begin in Osaka. Our friend Kathleen has called in today. Good morning, Kathleen. Go ahead.
I've got a question for Libby, and I won't disturb your show long. Libby, what is the correct name for those fireflies that come in the spring, early in the spring? The bright one, serendipitous?
Oh, now, we call them treetop flashers, but that's a good name for them, too. They are serendipitous, aren't they?
That come here, that have the bright light, and they tend to circle and come above the ground. They, I guess, originally from the mid-eastern coast around Virginia and Tennessee. I need to ask you, are they considered an endangered species, or do they have a habitat that can be enforced?
Okay.
Someone cut all the grass and all their habitat down in my gully, unbeknownst to me.
Well, none of our species of fireflies in the U.S. are listed as endangered species or even threatened so far. Of course, they haven't been studied a lot either because we talked about that before. They're just kind of benign little things that don't seem to do any harm or not particularly useful other than to entertain us. So they've never been protected, but they've also never been studied a lot. So if you want to protect yours, keep your lights off at night, or, you know, yard lights. When you go to bed, cut your lights off. That will help them a lot. They need time to be in the dark so they can find their mates and not be confused by artificial light. That'll help a lot of the insects that we enjoy watching or hearing, and also those that our birds need to eat. So keeping dim or no lights outside your house at night is a good idea, and a very minimum use of any kind of insect sprays will also help them. And not disturbing their ground. They don't like a mowed yard, particularly if they can have a more natural leaf cover yard. They prefer that.
Okay, thank you very much. All righty.
All right, Kathleen, thanks for your call. Let's get one other call in before our next break. So we go to Claudine, who calls in from Jackson. Good morning, Claudine. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm wondering about a male redbird. He's been attacking my house for the last 3 weeks. He's flies into a dining room window that has panes on it, and also to my front door, the glass. What could be going on, and what can I do?
Yeah, he's seeing his reflection, and he's in an aggressive mood, and it could be is this a male or a female? I've had it with both.
Male.
If you can break up that image, it will help. The easiest thing to do is to put a screen on the window if it's a window, you know, that you want a screen on or that you temporarily want a screen on. We've done that now to almost all of our windows, even though I would not have always preferred it for the view. But when you have the screens up, that if they do hit the window, it doesn't hurt them, and they're not as prone to hit the window because they're not seeing their reflection as clearly. And besides that, if anything, you could hang, like if you can close drapes in front of that curtain, that window for just a little, you know, for a few days while he's interested in it, that helps some. And anything you want to hang over the window inside or outside will make a little bit of a difference. Any kind of a drape. Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks, Claudine, for your phone call. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We'll continue talking with our guest, Christian Wagley, about the newly discovered Rice's whale and other coastal issues. Dr. Major remaining on the line, ready for pet questions. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and Libby Hartfield, retired director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Our guest for this hour is Christian Wagley, coastal organizer from Healthy Gulf. If you missed any of today's show, you can always subscribe to the podcast using any podcasting app, or better still, download the MPB Public Media app. Then you can listen to all the local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. If you want to join our conversation this morning, email animals@mpbonline.org. So, Christian, we're talking about the Rice's whale. Where in the Gulf are they located?
Well, that's a great question. So for years, scientists have mostly observed them in the northeastern Gulf of Mexico, and that's off the panhandle of Florida. And it's, again, in that in those deeper waters that I mentioned, their favorite area is that drop off where the continental shelf drops off into the deeper waters of the Gulf. So that's between about 100 and 400 meters, or that would be about 300 to 1200 feet in depth. And there's actually a place here off Pensacola about 60 miles out called the DeSoto Canyon. So it's a deeper kind of canyon formation that seems to be one of their favorite places. The speculation is that not only is there plenty of food there, but it may insulate them from some of the noise that occurs in the rest of the Gulf. And there are a lot of scientists that believe that the whales are more common in this eastern, northeastern part of the Gulf because the rest of the Gulf is so noisy and chaotic because of oil and gas drilling. And the coast of Florida is the only place in the Gulf that doesn't have that drilling. So that is where they're most common. But interestingly, they have been observed across all five Gulf states, and speculation even that they are occurring off Mexico. And a recent piece of research was published just a couple months ago that really confirmed that. They put listening devices, you know, out in the water to listen for Rice's whale calls off Texas and Louisiana and even off Mexico. And they found them on about anywhere from a quarter to a third of the days off Texas and Louisiana. They were hearing Rice's whales, and maybe only around 15% of the time they were hearing Rice's whales off of Mexico, just south of the border with Texas. So they are using those western Gulf areas off Texas and Louisiana, but not as commonly as they are in the eastern Gulf. And that could be, or is likely, because of the noise and chaos that exists in that western Gulf, which is so industrialized.
What is their diet?
Yeah, that's actually another interesting piece of work that has been published since we last spoke 3 years ago. There was speculation on what they were eating, weren't entirely sure, but it's known now that most of their diet is a small schooling fish called the silver rag drift fish. So again, they're mostly hanging out in those deeper water areas where the shelf drops off, and they dive deep down, hundreds of feet, many hundreds of feet down, and do what's called lunge feeding, where they open up their mouths and they literally just lunge through a school of fish and filter out thousands of fish at a time. And this silver rag drift fish is a fish that's very high in fat. And we know that fat equals energy. And so it's believed that the whales are willing to expend all of this effort, all of this energy to dive so deep down and make all this effort to get to these fish, because it presents a great return on that investment. It gives them back a lot of calories for their effort.
Do they stay in the Gulf year round, or do they possibly move in and out?
No, they do. They do stay in the Gulf of Mexico year round. It is a resident whale. There are certainly other whales and many other whales that migrate, but these whales do not. They stay in the Gulf of Mexico.
And what about their social life?
Yeah, there's not a lot known about that. And again, you have to remember, with only about 50 individuals out there being so critically endangered, one of the most endangered whales on the planet, they're difficult to observe, but scientists do go out at least every summer and look for them. And it's believed that they don't congregate in big, schools or pods, rather would be the term, but more like one or two at a time is what is typically seen. And we get these accounts oftentimes and most commonly from fishermen who go far offshore seeking some of the pelagic fish like marlin and swordfish and that sort of thing, they will sometimes capture a photo or a video and send those to me. And it's typically one or two whales at a time.
What about any kind of tracking or monitoring of the population? Is that going on?
No, that does not happen with the Rice's whales, or really even with most whales. There's a limitation on being able to attach a device for kind of a permanent tracking to a whale. There's not a good surface to do that on. It's not like where you can put a collar around the neck of a mammal, like a bobcat or something, for example. There's nowhere easy place to affix something. They will do that temporarily, so they'll put on a device that can stay on for 12 or 18 or 24 hours or something like that. And that, in fact, that was done to observe their habits, and that's how they know how much time they're at the surface, and they have this pattern of diving deep down to feed. But that was a temporary tag that was affixed very gently on the whales and made to break off after some short period of time. So there is not any kind of permanent tagging of the whales, and really unless there's some kind of new technology that develops, there's nothing like that coming soon.
Yeah, and when I asked that question, I wondered about that, because you're right, to put a little band on a bird is one thing, but with a large creature like a whale, that would have been kind of difficult to try to attach something there, I would guess.
That's right, and you have to be so careful. With so few animals remaining, you don't want to do anything that could potentially harm them in any way. And so, there's probably the ability to affix a tag that would penetrate the skin and be somewhat more permanent, but that potentially is a source of harm to the whales, right? It could open them up to stress and infection. And again, with so few animals remaining, they have to be so careful.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're visiting today with Christian Wagley, coastal organizer from Healthy Gulf. We'll have more talk in just a minute. Back to the phone lines we go, though. David has called in from Horn Lake. Good morning, David. It's your turn, so go ahead.
During the COVID outbreak, when everything was shut down, I went to my local library and got my grandkids interested in birds. So we put up feeders and I built some bird houses. Anyway, my grandkids are just super excited, because some of the houses we built, we actually got some bluebirds to put a nest in. They're nesting or what? Now, I got two questions. Number one, the bluebirds will go to the nest and they'll leave, and they'll carry something white in their beaks. Do you know what that is?
If there are already babies in that nest, that's probably what we call a fecal sac. And basically, they're changing the diapers. they like to keep their nest clean. And several kinds of species do that. I mean, several species of birds do that. But they... That I think that's probably what they're doing. If they're carrying it away from the nest.
They're carrying it away from the nest.
And that if you have made your boxes with a little lift up side so that you can look in them, are they those kind of boxes?
I made it with the front. I can take the front off to clean the nest out.
You can, yeah. If it's not real obtrusive, some of them are made so you can just lift it up and get a quick look and close it up. You could look in that box and just see. Bluebirds are pretty tolerant of that. If you don't look too often and you don't, rearrange anything in there or make a problem, but you and the kids could look in there and see if there are eggs or babies or just kind of what's going on. And
their heads. Their heads. I can see the little heads that are coming up. Their heads. Their
okay.
Heads whatnot. But my second question is... I saw a couple of cowbirds by the nest. I didn't see them actually go in. You mentioned about inspecting the nest. Can I inspect the nest and see if the cowbirds late contaminated the nest?
Yes, you can. Yeah. Sometimes if you take that nest out, take that egg or baby out, that's you're not really supposed to do that. Take it out, because then sometimes the cowbirds actually retaliate. But now the big protection for your bluebirds, if you made that nest box, and it sounds like you probably did according to what the books told you, the hole should be just small enough that the cowbird can't get in there.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, David.
Okay, so good luck. Okay.
Good to hear from you, David. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're visiting today with Christian Wagley, coastal organizer from Healthy Gulf. So, Christian, the focus of Healthy Gulf is to serve communities who love the Gulf of Mexico and want to reverse the long pattern of over-exploitation of the Gulf's natural resources. Tell us some of the ways that the organization is working to meet those goals.
Yeah, one of the key ways that we do that is working with communities all along the Gulf Coast that are impacted by pollution and other environmental issues. And so a lot of times we have people in the community that are concerned about an issue and they want to get engaged around it. And sometimes they need some help. They may need some help with how to organize their neighbors and hold public meetings and bring people together on this. And that's something we help people with. And another thing is the science. So we do science-based advocacy. Science really informs the work that we do. And so we help communities providing them the science that's needed to help them make the case for, say, shutting down a facility or improving a facility that may be causing pollution or, in the case of an endangered species like a whale, again, bringing people together to advocate in support of conservation measures. But really, we rely on the people, our members and our supporters and allies all on the Gulf Coast. These are the people that are rooted in these communities and know what's best and going on. And our duty is just to support them and provide the things that they need around organizing and the science to help them make the case.
You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We will continue talking with our guest, Christian Wagley of Healthy Gulf. This is MPB Think Radio. You're listening to Creature Comforts. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major and Libby Hartfield. And our guest today is Christian Wagley from Healthy Gulf. Still time to join our conversation this morning. You can email animals@mpbonline.org. So, Christian, you told us the story of the Rice's whale, that it was a beached whale that was discovered, and that led to the understanding that they were a separate species of whale and not a subspecies of that other whale. Do you think that we would have ever found that out had the one whale not beached?
Well, I'm not sure. It certainly would have been delayed, and perhaps not, because those were two critical pieces of information they needed. And again, we didn't have a specimen to work from without that one, unfortunately, coming ashore dead. And again, that allowed for the skull analysis and the DNA analysis. So, I think if that hadn't happened, we'd still be sitting here today talking about a subspecies of Brutus whale, even though there was some evidence that it was a distinct species. But scientists won't make that conclusion without that strong line of evidence. And in this case, they had two lines of evidence, the skull morphology and the DNA.
And as you mentioned, they're critically endangered. I think we've mentioned a couple of times only about 50 of the whales left. Is the signs pointing towards maybe increasing the population? I mean, do we know anything about their mating habits? And hopefully there might be some new whales added to the group?
Well, we would certainly hope for that. But unfortunately, right now, the evidence is that we're trending in the wrong direction. The science says that the whales can only handle one additional death of a whale due to human activities every 14 years or so. And the best evidence says that that rate is being exceeded right now, which means that it's believed that the population is trending in a negative direction. And obviously that just can't happen with only 50 animals or so remaining. It's important to note that, and this Saturday is the 14th anniversary of the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, and scientists have estimated that disaster resulted in about a 22% decline in the population of the Rice's whale. So absolutely a catastrophic event. And as long as there's continued drilling on the Gulf, that's a threat that looms every day for the whales. And ultimately, we've got to transition away from the fossil fuels, and the drilling has to be gone from the Gulf largely in order for the whales to reclaim that former habitat. Again, they're being largely excluded from these areas in the Western Gulf. They're going over there a little bit, but not in the numbers they should because of the outsized influence of oil and gas out there. So that's got to transition away over the next few decades as we move toward cleaner forms of energy.
So for anyone that's listening that's concerned about the state of the Gulf of Mexico or some of these threats that you've been talking about, what can the kind of the average Joe do to help out?
Well, it's something that we're engaging people all along the Gulf Coast around to weigh in on some of the conservation actions that are being proposed. And so I think the first thing, though, is just getting educated, what your listeners are doing today, learning about these whales and the fact that they're out there. One of the things for the Gulf Coast here is we don't have what I call a whale culture. So there's other areas like on the East Coast, on the Atlantic coast, where we have the North Atlantic right whale, and they come close to shore and people see them more often. And there are even whale watching tours, you know, up in the Northeast. So there's sort of this whale culture out there. Here on the Gulf Coast, we're not used to seeing that many whales. There certainly are other whales out there in addition to the Rice's whales. And so we don't have that, we don't have that culture around the whales so much, and that conservation ethic around whales and people thinking about whales in the Gulf of Mexico. So one of the things we're doing for that is we're actually having the first ever Gulf Coast Whale Festival is going to be here on Pensacola Beach Saturday, April 27. There'll be life-size inflatable whales and lots of education and amazing things happening. So that's part of building that, that culture around the whales and that education for people to know that they're out there and they need help. And then a second thing of that is I think for the public to weigh in on these conservation actions, such as supporting the critical habitat designation that's going to come out this summer. And potentially at some point, not too far after that, likely to see some speed restrictions on vessels, again, in that narrow band offshore proposed. And we will be counting on the people of the Gulf Coast, people like your listeners, to try to get involved in that process in support of that, because those speed restrictions are a proven way to save whales.
And would that involve contacting both maybe state and federal representatives?
Yes, and probably mainly the federal government at that point. You know, one of the wonderful things about living in the United States of America is we have these wonderful environmental laws at the federal level that protect the whales and do a lot of other things. And there are these very formal periods where they have to take in public comment on that, and they really weigh those issues in making a decision. And so we expect that that will happen again around the speed restrictions issue. And that's an opportunity for the public to type out an email and send that in to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and show that that we support whale conservation and we can strike the right balance. We can still do so many of the things that we're used to doing on the Gulf Coast. It's not going to affect people much. It's just a small area offshore where it's really most critical to conservation of the whales. And we need those speed restrictions to help give the whales a chance to avoid those vessel strikes, which, again, are perhaps the primary threat to the whales in the Gulf.
And are there other issues affecting the Gulf that might not be on everyone's radar?
Well, I mentioned earlier one that's a new one that not many people know about, and that's proposed aquaculture. So right now there are no large-scale kind of industrial-sized fish farms in federal waters off the continental U.S. So that's the Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf Coast. They're just not out there, and the federal government is actually, though, moving that forward. And the first two fish farms are proposed for off of Florida. One has already been permitted off the Sarasota area. It's being held up by a legal challenge from consumer and conservation organizations. And another one is proposed offshore from Pensacola Beach. And these are massive farms with, you know, many, many millions of fish. And in other areas, these fish farms have been shown to not only create an entanglement hazard where whales or other marine mammals can accidentally get entangled in a rope or line or part of a cage, but they also can change some of the foraging and movements of whales and other marine mammals by putting a series of big structures out there that interferes with their foraging and where they migrate and those sorts of things. So that is an emerging threat that we're very aware of and we're engaging people around.
Got a couple minutes left. Are there any other potential mystery species out there lurking in the Gulf?
Well, I think there probably are. You know, there's always this saying about how we know more about the face of the moon than some of our deep water areas. Again, you know, the Rice's whales, we've known they were there for many, many years. So no one should think that that's, when we say it's a new species, that people didn't know they were out there. We've known that for many, many years and been working on them. But I think there could well be some new species probably in the deep waters of the Gulf, and that might be smaller species in size, not big fish or big marine mammals like whales, but there could be some crustaceans and small deep sea corals and other things that live way out offshore and in very deep water, places that are really hard to get to, hard to study. And so there's not a lot of science going on out in those places. I think it's quite likely that a new species of some of those smaller invertebrates especially will be found. But I don't think it's likely we're going to find new species of, say, vertebrates in the Gulf, at least species that we don't already know about. Now, sometimes, again, from that taxonomic standpoint of how scientists classify animals, they may determine, as they did with the Rice's whales, that something's a new species, even though they already know about it and they're studying it. But the ocean's a fascinating place. I think there are still many new discoveries to be made in the Gulf of Mexico.
All right, and just to wrap us up, does Healthy Gulf have like a website if someone is listening and wants to learn more about the goals and the work of Healthy Gulf? Where would you point them to?
Sure. So that's healthygulf.org, and we've got a great page set up with information about the rhesus whales where folks can learn more about them and so many other conservation issues that we're working on all along the Gulf Coast.
All right, very good. And so, Libby, I've got an on-air suggestion for a future show. You know, the cicadas are coming, so maybe in the coming weeks we can talk about what that might mean, because it's going to be, what, two broods kind of coming out at the same time. So that should be something interesting.
Yeah, and great minds think alike, I guess. I just talked with an entomologist, and I think it's going to be on next week.
All right.
We'll have to get our cicada questions answered. And while I was listening to the last 5 minutes, I just found two little Gulf Coast box turtles. And so I guess maybe I'm going to start herping a little bit today instead of just birding.
All right. That's going to wrap us up for today. Creature Comforts is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio, with funding provided in part by listeners. To hear today's show or previous show, you can visit mpbonline.org/creaturecomforts. Our show is produced by Abram Nanny, and our call screener today was Charles Arnold. So for Dr. Troy Major, Libby Hartfield, and our guest, Christian Wagley, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to stay tuned, because up next, it's AutoCorrect with Coach Charlie Melton. We'll be back next Thursday at 9 for another Creature Conference, heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.